This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Alessia Russo's back heel. What a moment. And England are into the final of the Euros. A slow start, but then a brilliant performance all over the pitch. From Mary Earp's early save to Beth Mead's unerring finish. And the absolute filth from Russo to seal it all. Adding a deserved fourth from Frank Kirby. Lucy Bronze's header. And now the women get the chance to emulate the men. An agonising penalty defeat to France or Germany. Or you never know, it could be their first ever major trophy. We'll spend most of the pod looking back at last night. If there's time, we'll ask if it's helpful for Sir Alex Ferguson to turn up and help with the Ronaldo negotiations, any other business, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, fresh from commentating, in front of millions on BBC One, Robin Cowan, welcome.
Well, thanks, Max. I tried to think about that fact too much, but yeah.
I'm amazed you're still sullying yourself with us.
This is the peak. This is it.
Former England international Anita Asante. Welcome, Anita.
Hiya, Max. Glad to be on.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. Jordan Jarrett-Bryan and his hot takes. Hello, mate.
Good morning, pal. How are you?
Robin, you were there then. You were commentating. How was it?
Very, very special. Very special. It was... I still can't quite believe that happened, because this stuff doesn't really happen to England, men's, women's, whatever. and as you mentioned, it didn't start very well, very nervy, and Sweden looked like they were executing a very effective game plan. But as we've seen throughout the tournament with Sweden, they just can't quite reach the level they were kind of hyped up. And then, England just started scoring and... to be honest, taking the piss. I mean, Russo, she's having her own goal of the tournament sort of competition on her own. The Northern Ireland one was good enough, you know, that little turn and shot. This one, I mean, Ian Wright was saying, you know, she actually missed a sitter, you know, she should have scored the first time. But then to do that, I mean, yeah, those sort of banter football accounts would be like, oh, they have a family, that sort of thing. I mean, it was just, to do that in a semi-final of a major tournament, it's just unthinkable. So yeah, it was amazing.
Anita, that was the moment where I really sat up straight and was like, you know, sort of made involuntary noises. It was worth her missing the sitter to do that, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think that was what like makes you feel about, this is what tournament's about, tournament football. These like magic moments that like individuals, you know, produce and that you're going to talk about with your mates for weeks on weeks on end to come. And you're going to see kids trying to replicate at their power leagues, those types of goals. So yeah, it was a fantastic moment for her, but it was incredible for England as well, to show that they could come out that second half and dominate a game and put a team like Sweden, second in the world, on their heels.
Jordan, I'm waiting for you to say it wasn't that good a goal.
I just want to put it out there. It wasn't the best goal of the night, in my opinion. I thought Beth Mead's goal was the best goal of the night. I thought it was a real striker type finish goal. That goal gave me the most amount of pleasure. But yeah, Russo's taken absolute liberties, and it was compared. I was at an event last night, so I only saw the last 25 minutes, and I watched back the first hour this morning. And I was listening to a lot of the callers and over a couple of us splitting between two different radio stations, just listening to the reaction to the win and to the goal. And I think that people are comparing it to the Thierry Henry goal for Arsenal in 2004, I think it was. The reason why I think Russo's goal was better was because it was instinctive, where if you look at Henry's goal, he's holding a player off and he's thinking about what can I do? Oh, I'm going to do this. Whereas Russo's goal was just, I'm just doing it. There was no time to think about it. I think that kind of slightly gives it the edge if we're going to compare the two types of goals. But yeah, no, it wasn't the best goal of the night for me. So I don't want to poo-poo the goal too much. It was a brilliant goal. It was an absolute liberty. But as Robin says, she's taking quality goals in competition to another level. Big fan of her.
I think with Alessia Russo, and it's throughout the whole team, to try that, that comes down to the manager giving them that confidence, that freedom to do that, because I just don't think many players would do that in that situation, you know, with the crowd and the weight of sort of what the result would mean. And I just think that's just, I can't praise the manager highly enough. They're playing with such clarity and freedom and belief. And just the fact that she tried that and it came off, just that's what Serena Wiegmann has given this team.
I was sort of texting the TalkSport presenter, Paul Hawksby, about, you know, should Ellen White or Alicia Russo be starting? And I actually thought White did her job yesterday, and I'm not sure she has been all tournament. I thought she played really well. And then I was like, I like Russo coming off the bench. And it's like bringing on Grant Holt because, you know, like... And then Russo did that, and I thought, I'm not sure Grant Holt would do that back here. Well, like, I may be doing him a massive disservice. I then went on this sort of, I don't know if I got myself very confused about the legality of a nutmeg and what actually a nutmeg is, because I sort of feel, and you obviously played many times for England, and I don't know if you ever had this debate in the dressing room, feels to me that a nutmeg, you need to collect the ball yourself, right? If you're just putting it through the keeper's legs, then you're just putting it through the keeper's legs. That was my view. That guy who says sheet a lot in The Wire, I've forgotten what bunk from The Wire, he thinks it is a nutmeg. I don't know. You can choose one side or the other, Anita.
Nah, it's a nutmeg still, I think. Yeah, I mean, through the legs... is a nut, but maybe there's levels to this, you know. That's a different type of nutmeg. Is a nutmeg finish, or a nutmeg that we saw, I think Georgia Stanway did in the middle of the park, through a player and collected the other side. That was a clean nutmeg. But I know what you're saying, like normally when we play rondos and there's those iffy nutmegs that come off someone's, you know, heel or the whatever thigh, I don't count those. It has to be clean.
No. And then everyone bursts into hysterics. It's the most amazing moment on earth. Yeah, you're like, no, it's exactly. Not funny. It's not even nutmeg. Anyway, I confused myself. Afterwards, Anita, Alex Scott was pretty emotional talking about not just the players on the pitch, but like all the investment that's gone before, the people involved to get to this stage, which includes, you know, players like you. I mean, is that how you felt at full time about this moment? Or were you just kind of half cut in a pub in Bristol going, this is great?
No, I think it was an emotional moment. I think for everyone that's been committed to the game, whether you've been on the pitch around it to see, you know, the levels in terms of attendances, the quality on the pitch, what this moment will mean for the legacy of women's game in England as well, and how it can continue is immense. You know, I think people forget that the girls that are playing today, they are aware of the weight of kind of what they're doing for the wider good of the game. You know, they don't go out there every day carrying that on their shoulders, but there is that sense of like, we are, or they are, you know, helping progress the game forward and challenge kind of the culture and improving resources and opportunities and all of those things. So when they do well, everyone has the opportunity to benefit in the long term. So it is emotional, because none of us, you know, I was sat at a pub with all types of people, you know, men, women, kids, families, whatever, celebrating and cheering and being invested in this team. And never did I think we'd get that kind of even pub culture where people are coming to watch women's football in their droves as well.
And just to add to Anita's point there, as I mentioned, I was really keen. Robin and Anita can talk about the actual game itself. They're far more qualified and knowledgeable on that than I am. But what I'm interested in is the reaction to what England are doing and what women's football is moving, the space it's now moving into. And listening to a lot of the callers on the two stations I was listening to last night, there were callers that were saying, you know, I want to apologise because I called up 2 weeks ago and I was saying this women's football is this and that, and actually it's really good and this team are really technically gifted. And I thought that was really, really interesting. And whilst I don't think that we should be, like, I've played golf. I hate golf. I don't like it. Tiramisu, I lived in Italy. I hate tiramisu. Lots of people love it. Robocop, the film I'm thinking of now. There are things that other people like that I don't like. We shouldn't be, I think, marginalizing people that don't like women's football. That's fine. I think as long as they respect those that do, I think it's fine. But I find it interesting that there's a lot of, mainly men, that seem to be now actually respecting what they're seeing. And I think this tournament actually has been, the word I would use is fun. I've really enjoyed watching this, as well as the high quality of football that we're seeing from England. The first game wasn't fun. It was quite drab, but most first games, to be fair, are. But I'm just interested in the reaction from people that maybe weren't really invested in women's football, who now, I wouldn't say they're probably necessarily fans of women's football, but they're actually now learning to appreciate and respect the skill, the dedication, the work that's been put in to get into this England team to where it's got to now. And I think that whilst we shouldn't, like I say, marginalise those that don't love it, I think we should also understand that there are lots of people now that are coming round to the idea that this is high quality football.
Golf tiramisu Robocop. I mean, my mind, that even flagged Gareth Bale in a different world would be holding. Producer Joel just says, golf tiramisu Robocop. What a Saturday that is. What a lovely day. What a beautiful
nightmare
day.
For Jordan. That would be the worst day ever.
I think making it, yeah. But it's an interesting point that Jordan makes there, Robin. You know, like my 83-year-old dad is WhatsApping me during that game. Like that's not happening. Actually, not just from him to me, but both ways 4 or 5 years ago. You know, like my mates' WhatsApp groups are talking about that. And I suppose there's a sort of drip effect. I guess we can talk later as to, this is a tournament. There's no other football happening at the moment. So all eyes are on this. And actually it happens with the men's tournament as well. Lots of people start watching the games who don't really have any interest in football. It doesn't necessarily mean there'll be a huge increase in attendance in WSL, but it's a drip effect, right? It doesn't happen overnight. And there are, like Ian Wright said afterwards, so many young girls watching that getting inspired, and young boys as well, who women's football will not be weird to them. I've said this before, but when I was 10, women playing football was just a joke, right? It wasn't, and it was like, don't be silly, that doesn't happen. Whereas my son, who's 4 months old, won't have that growing up.
Totally. No, that's the key. Yeah, no, when I played at school, I was the only girl in a boys' team in primary school. I was seen as very strange. And I'm just so excited for those who are, you know, will go. Yeah, as I say, it's not weird to see young girls of all ages playing now. And I think I'm really pleased that Jordan's raised that it's fantastic to hear people say, oh, I've actually watched it. There are people who still haven't watched any women's football and say it's shit, which I don't really think is naming no names. But the fact that they're actually watching it and changing their mind is great. And you're absolutely right, Jordan. We shouldn't sort of, you know, if people don't enjoy it, that's fine. The only thing I would say is they don't have to tell us they don't enjoy it. I don't send out a list of everything I hate. This is the thing. I think it's a social media thing, really, isn't it? You know, if you tweeted that you hated RoboCop and then, you know, the whole internet exploded because people need to have their opinion heard. So it's great. And I think generally this country, they, especially with football, no matter who it is, if England doing well at something, you know, I don't really watch rugby, but if England are doing well, you know, and they get to a final, I will watch it. So, it's great. It's just great. You know, there's a real feel-good factor around the place.
Back to the game, Anita. I mean, there were so many brilliant performances on the pitch. I thought Lauren Hemp was excellent down the left. Rachel Daly, especially after the Spain game, you know, lots of people didn't think she'd start. And I thought she had such a, sort of from the beginning, she had a brilliant game. Fran Kirby was so good. I mean, it's hard to pick someone out. I don't know who, if you want to single anyone out or any performances you thought were particularly impressive last night.
Yeah, I think we've got to give a shout out to Mary Earps, because 20 seconds into the game, she doesn't make that save. We're watching a different game potentially, in my opinion. So I think she stepped up in two really big moments. She did that in the Spain game as well. She has relatively few caps that you know, for England, but she showed her maturity, her leadership as well. You take all the football out of it, I think just her body language. If you notice, when they were stressed out and you know the pressure was coming from Sweden, she was the one fanning her arms up and down, you know, marshalling orders to the back line and to everyone, trying to settle the team. And I liked to see that. And I liked to see that someone took responsibility and she had the confidence to do that in a you know, a pivotal moment. And of course it gives everyone that, like, yeah, come on, we're in this type feeling when a goalkeeper makes a save. So, you know, I think you've got to give a lot of credit to Mary Earps, who really kept the girls in it. But yeah, so many good performances in the end. You know, you saw Fran Kirby show her magic, what she's about, getting in between the pockets, finding forward passes, linking play. Lauren Hemp, who has largely at times been nullified by opposition teams, because we've all been bragging about how good she is. We've almost done her a disservice because everyone's been on the tactics board. How can we stop Lauren? But I think she found some space and was able to show her attributes, you know, her speed, her pace with the ball, you know, just getting into the creative phase and linking play. Ultimately, that's what we want to see. You know, my main thing is that I want to see the girls show that level of confidence that they had towards the end of the game, the second half, come the final, start in the game. I want them to just come out and believe that they can bring out a performance like that in the first half as well.
Can I just say, I'm not having that Mary Earp save, the one that was tipped over the bar. The hyperbole that I heard, it's like, that is, as a goalkeeper, and I'm not a goalkeeper, that's the one place you want the ball to be, down the middle, the top. That's where you are. And I don't know if, Robin, you were part of this gang, but I heard everybody going crazy about that save. I'm like, that is not a difficult save to make. Bottom corner, top corner, yeah. Not down the middle. If you're a goalkeeper getting beaten down the middle, that's not a great save. And I heard a lot of people going crazy about, she made some brilliant saves during the game. Oh, that was not
spicy.
One of them.
The hot takes coming in hot, aren't they? No, I think you're right. I do think you're right. Maybe I was going a bit over the top as well. But I think generally this tournament, she's been pretty much flawless, Mary Earps, from start to finish. I think she's one of the most accurate passes as well in the tournaments. You know, it's so much more than we see. And also her facials are so good as well. I love it. She's very, I mean, I really don't like to compare male and female, but she is like Pickford's opposite, isn't she? She's just so, she's got a real swagger about her and I love it.
There's always talk about quality of goalkeeping, right? And, you know, it's always become this sort of like this issue where you either just talk about it all the time or you're too scared to ever say, actually, I don't think that was a great save, or that was pretty bad. I actually thought, because a lot was said after the Russo back heel, and I'd never heard the phrase, stay clever, keep them together, that Aaron Ramsdale tweeted out, you know, for if you're a goalkeeper. But I actually thought there, and I think sometimes goalkeepers get, you know, too much praise. I actually thought, that's happening so quickly, that Russo back heel. And like to react to that would have been, you can be unlucky. It could have hit her in the leg, whatever. Clearly, she's at fault for the Frank Kirby goal. But by that time, Anita, the game's sort of done, isn't it?
Yeah, it was at 4-0. It's gone. You know, the heads have gone. You saw that in some of the clearances. I think Bjorn tries to make a clearance in the box, slices it, almost ends up potentially in the back of the net, just goes over. But again, like you said, it was instinctive by Russo. I don't think Hedvig Lindahl could react to that necessarily quick enough. She actually had two of her defenders right with Russo trying to usher her off the pitch. She probably expected the defenders to do a better job than they did in that scenario. So she wasn't alert. But of course, you can argue that a goalkeeper should always be ready, you know, always be on their toes and have that concentration. So for that reason, you know, she maybe gave too much trust to her defenders in that scenario. She should have been thinking worst case scenario. But again, that's the beauty of football. It is instinctive and these moments will happen. And like I said before, there was a bit of panic in that Swedish defence because of the chances that England had created and the goals they'd also conceded, that lots of players were making rash decisions and rash clearances where they weren't getting clean contact.
I think it's really important. And like you, Robin, I try to not compare the men and women's game, and I find myself doing it by mistake quite a lot, but I think just to contextualize what England are doing, we should do that, because they're beating up top teams. For those that don't follow the women's game, Sweden and Spain are not, like, they're not jokes. This is the equivalent, I'm going to do it now, of England beating, I don't know,
can you think of two football teams? Go on, John. Do your best. I'm not helping you here, mate. Come on.
Well, this is, you know, Barry always brings up, you know, about, you know, the England men saying that they got a very easy path, like, you know, in 2018, wasn't it, to the semi-final. This has not been an easy path. They had a fairly simple group stage, you could argue, although we thought Norway would be better. And they obviously weren't. So, yeah, no, I get what you're saying, John. Which team should we go for?
Let's go for this. This is like them beating up Portugal and Argentina. Is that fair? Is that fair? Two top men's nations. Is that a fair equivalent?
Yeah. Do we go with that? Not quite France, but sort of, yeah.
Not quite the best, but two of Sweden were on the pre-tournament favourites to win this.
Yeah.
And to smash them up 4-0 in a semi-final, that is That's a big deal. That's a really big deal, I think.
Anita, do we have to have the Ellen White or Alicia Russo who starts conversation? You wrote a piece that I completely agreed with, actually, about Ellen White starting. Or do we just say Serena Wiegman knows what she's doing, right?
Yeah, and Serena we trust, right? I mean, everything she's done so far has proven to work. This debate is going to run, you know, this is whether we like it or not. And like I said, when I wrote about it, was just that people also don't look for the work that players do off the ball very often. They only really focus on what players do on the ball. And that's, you know, whether they're scoring goals or assisting. And of course, that is her role as well. But, you know, a lot of the way England play now is also through their pressing game, you know, how to sort of stifle the opposition when they're out of possession and things like that. And Ellen does that tirelessly and will do that, you know, without a second thought for a team. And, you know, if you look at the way that England were playing as well, most teams, you're not getting that space first half of a game because it's always a bit cagey. It's always both teams trying to feel out each other. You don't necessarily have the rhythm. And in fairness to Ellen, England didn't have a lot of ball possession, you know, in some of these games, especially in the first half, where you're not getting necessarily the kind of service that a player like her, for her attributes, needs. You know, she likes to pin defenders and connect and link players and then get herself into the box. She's a kind of a box player. She likes to work within that 18, but she will also run channels. And that wasn't really happening as often. But at the same time, Alessia Russo, we don't know how she would cope coming into the start of a semi-final with that kind of pressure and whatever either. But what we can say is that she's a great student of the game because whatever she's doing from the bench, I feel like she's watching the opposition. She's figuring out what spaces she can exploit with her attributes and how she can help the team create and things like that. And also all the work that you do, I know what it's like as a defender. I remember playing for England when you play Germany or France and you've worked 40, 60 minutes into a game, you're thinking, bloody hell, who's coming on now? And then you see that winger warming up or that forward and it's Elodie Tommy who's rapid or someone and you're going, got my work cut out for me now for the next 15 minutes. So all that tireless work Ellen's done, driving them, you know, draining them of energy, Alessia can come on and capitalise on.
I just think it's like this whole sort of thing of starters and finishers, because I think Alessia Russo yesterday came on in around the 55th minute. So like she's not actually getting that much less game time than Ellen White. And the other thing is I do think things have changed because of the five subs that you can make changes slightly earlier. And it'll be interesting to see because obviously that's going to come into the Premier League next season. So I think it really changes things quite a lot.
Just to quickly say, yeah, I think that kind of also lends itself to the management that Serena Wiegman has been employing as well. I've been really impressed by not only her tactical decisions that have been questioned, but yet she's in a final. So can you question them that much? A bit like Southgate, again, I'm doing the comparison thing here. Last year was questioned a lot about who he should play, but it got to the final. And just the way she carries herself as well, generally, I like her demeanor. I like what she says. She's very, very focused without being boring and dull. And I think that what she'll be saying, I don't know her, but I imagine from what I've seen her, what she'll be saying is what we've achieved so far is an achievement. It's not success. Go and win on Sunday. That is success. I think it's important that we realize that a final is not it's not success. Success is winning the thing. But what they have done is achieve something. But now enjoy the semis. But let's now focus and get the job done by seeing it through and not letting this be one of those, England got so far, but fell at the final hurdle.
Can I just pick up on your sort of reluctance to compare the games? And I wonder, Anita, if it's something that really annoys you or not. I think when I'm watching football, I'm always comparing it, right? Because I'm always sort of basically thinking about the 90s because life was easier, right? So like my frame of reference is always comparing whatever football I'm watching to either Cambridge United the 90s or the Premier League or whatever. So I don't actually have a problem with it at all as long as it's done in a sort of in a fair way. Or do you find constant comparisons annoying?
Oh, that's a good way to put it. I don't know. I don't find it annoying as such. It depends on what context and what the kind of agenda is when people make that comparison. you know, if you just love sport and you love football, you look at the game the same way, whether it's men or women. And that's how I look at the game. I love watching men's football. I grew up watching it. Some of those guys are idols for me. That's also inspired me to play. I don't look at gender as the basis for doing anything as such. But, you know, if you love the game and you love whether it's the tactical side of it, whether it's the individuals and their attributes and things like that, I think you can appreciate either or if you're just looking at it through a lens of like, you love football, you know. But when people seek to kind of diminish or undermine one game to the other, or place one on a like kind of hierarchy and compare a thing to it for that reason without any context, that's when it annoys me, because you literally just got baseless arguments, you know, especially with the women's game, in terms of, you know, we understand, all of us that work within it and play the game, that it's still new in the professional sense compared to the men's game. So I'm not going to compare a game that is, you know, 200 years older than the women's game on all levels, when clearly the women's game is not there yet in every dimension.
Sorry, Max, I personally have an issue when I constantly hear the stats that, you know, Ellen White is one goal away from becoming England's record goal scoring. I don't like the lumping in of the men's, women's, because I just don't, because how far do you go with that? If someone under 16 level scores more goals than Wayne Rooney, do you then include that as well? I don't like that. But a question I have for Anita and to Robin, I'm asking a lot of the women I know that work in the game and beyond, do you guys have an issue with the game being called women's football? Or do you prefer it just be called football and it just happens to be played by women?
I think I'd prefer not to have the women's football, to be honest. But sometimes you need that comparison. That's a really interesting one though, because like you're kind of told occasionally, you're kind of doing updates on a radio station and that you're kind of told, oh, you know, the audience might not know. So if you say, oh, it's Chelsea women won.
That's why I ask. I did a show last week and someone said to me, you can't just say England, because people might think you're talking about, you know, Harry Kane's England. And it's like, well, there's a Euros going on. So I think most people know we're talking about the women's game, but then maybe they don't. And
for me, I don't mind really, because I think the, of course, in general, in terms of equality and all of that, like, yeah, you know, the ideal is to be like, oh, we could just talk about football in this very general way related to everyone. But the reality is not everyone knows, and you need to sort of be specific at times. And also, I think it's this idea that, you know, women should be proud to be women and women in sport. And it's come from the notion of that women in the past have not been associated with sport in general, or given praise and props for what they do in sport. Do you know what I mean? So like, for me, it's also about like bringing a kind of highlight or spotlighting women and women in sport across sports is really important, that we just embrace that as well. So for me, it's not an issue.
Should we say men's football then? Men's football, that way it's very clear and it's equal.
Yeah, I mean, for me, why not? Because the point is, I know what you're saying. You're saying that because men's football has been seen as the gold standard and the norm, that's why we're specific about everything else. But if we just bring parity to everything and you're saying men's or women's football, then you're specific on both accounts. Like, really, people shouldn't be offended by that.
Jordan, they were very good questions. But, you know, you host one pod and then you just start asking all the questions. You know,
like, I can go.
It's all right, mate. You're all right. Look, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin by asking, will England win the Euros? Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly.
Robin, are England going to win it?
They can win it. They are certainly capable. Yeah. Will they? I don't know. We have to find out. We still don't know who they're going to play yet, do we? France, Germany tonight, both have been impressive. In my opinion, I'm slightly more scared of Germany. I'm not sure if that's just a natural inclination as an English football fan, a kind of natural fear of Germans playing football. But they certainly can. It's a home tournament. I really think the crowd have helped an awful lot, you know, when they've had difficult moments. And also, they've got the best possible manager in charge, and she's done it before, and she can do it again. But I will say, whether it's France or Germany, the opposition have gone up another notch in the final. So don't think they'll be able to afford another poor start, no matter what happens.
I think I'm more scared of France than Germany.
They're slightly more chaotic, aren't they?
They're chaotic, but there's a real sort of athleticism and pace about them. Anita, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a difficult one to call. Between the two sides, the different styles of play as well, you got to factor in. But I agree with you. I think France had the flair players, the ones that cause chaos. Probably for the football that I enjoy to watch, they're that kind of team. But Germany, I just think they're just so efficient in every position and probably have good balance back to front, just watching them, that I'm a bit more afraid of them. And I guess as well, from my own experience of playing against Alexandra Popp over the years.
Yeah.
And all I have is nightmares of her sending us out of Champions League and stuff, that I kind of just worry about her in specifically set-piece situations, like corners, because she's so good in the air and she's got that physicality. It'll be a great test with her and Millie, for example, going, you know, against each other. But something about Germans and the legacy in this competition as well, I think.
What made Pop so difficult to play against?
I just think she's ruthless. Like, she's so determined to score and win, like, for every team she's played for. She will just keep doing those things time and time again.
But aren't you all that level? Aren't you, she's even more ruthless?
Well, I think she's had really good players to try to emulate. Like, Birgit Prinz was one of the all-time goal scorers for Germany when they dominated European football. So she grew up in that time where they got to watch Germany win all the time and know, like, you're stepping into those shoes and you want to carry that mantle forward. So I think it's kind of like ingrained in her specifically, but those players that, you know, this is huge for them as a nation, and them individually. But she's such a threat in the air as well. And like I said, and I think in the women's game, you're still probably hard pressed to find a good chunk of players that are really brave in those box situations where they know their nose could potentially fall off. And she's that player will just commit to every ball. And that for me is always a threat, because you just got to be alert as a defender in the box all the time, because she doesn't let you rest, is what I'm saying.
Robin, are you shitting yourself about doing the final?
Yes.
Do you go, it's just muscle memory, it's just the same as any other game, just cross that white line? Because I was just really conscious, because I know you, that the Russo back heel, it's like a massive moment, and you've got to really in that split second go, how, what do you do? And I thought you actually got that spot on.
I disagree.
Do
no,
you?
I wasn't happy with that, because I just couldn't find the words. And so many people have said it better. Outrageous, genius, you know. But yeah, I mean, the kind of big TV execs were there yesterday and they just said, it's just another game. I was like, no, it's not. This isn't just another game.
And actually, you don't want the big execs there. You just want, you know, don't want
management
suits. There.
No.
Yeah, get out
just
of there.
Just want Ian Wright.
You know, you've made your choice. Exactly. Like, are you, I mean, it's a, what a privilege, right? To be doing what you're doing.
I can't believe it. It's just, it's been the privilege of my life. And I really need to emphasize this. I play a very small role in this. It's just kind of like background noise. It's all the team doing this. They are just a pleasure to watch. And just generally this tournament, not just done England. I think it's the first time I've really not had to kind of, because I've been covering women's football so long, and at the start I was way too tub thumping. You know, I was like, oh, this is great. This is brilliant. Because the quality's been so high, I felt much more comfortable being able to criticise properly And yeah, when someone's made a mistake, it's been a big mistake. And yeah, no, it's just been the quality of this tournament, just been incredible. It's been brilliant. And yes, I'm trying not to think about Sunday too much. I don't know what I'm going to do between now and then. What am I going to do? I don't know. Ice baths, sort of recovery, things like that.
Although, to be fair, you were a bit easy on Ellen White when she went down like a sack of spuds.
I thought that was a pen. Yeah, no, I actually did. I think maybe I was, lioness's tinted spectacles. You're right. But yeah, that's really funny, was that, yeah, there's been quite a lot of criticism, hasn't there, of a few pieces of probably men who haven't really watched the women's game. I don't know if you saw yesterday.
Yeah.
There was a piece of, oh, there's no shithousery in women's football. Isn't that great? And actually on the piece, it was the picture of Ellen White who'd just taken a dive for a penalty. So that was quite funny.
I thought that was quite an interesting, I had Tim Stillman's on tomorrow and we actually quite an interesting sort of pleasant chat on Twitter, which I know that's not what Twitter's for, about that, because I haven't read the Sam Cunningham piece about, I can't say if he was saying there's no shithousery, but there is less, I think.
Definitely.
And I love shithousery, right? I just think it's great. And so I'm happy for it to be in the women's game. I guess I wonder if there's this feeling about, like, when Cambridge started getting good and then other fans came and you were like, what are you doing? Like, you weren't here when we were shit, and so this idea that if you've been covering the game for so long, that other people coming in and sort of just having their opinion might be a bit annoying. But then I think also there's another point about the atmosphere, right? Which seems great. I saw my mate Charlie Baker tweeting yesterday going, what's great is there's just no aggro. Maybe just men can't cope with football. Like, the atmosphere does seem great. And once again, I know we're comparing it all the time. Jordan, your hand is up. But like, there are things that I think are really positive that are slightly different.
I think it's a really good point. And I saw a video yesterday, Max, of I think it was at Trafalgar Square when I think the third goal went in. And just the celebrating was normal. It wasn't beer everywhere. It wasn't really violent and physical. It was just people celebrating and smiling and jumping around in a very, very normal, respectful way. And I'm going to the final on Sunday and I'm really keen to see. I've been to women's football many times before, but I'm really keen to see how a home final with the women's team is taken by the public. And again, I'm comparing, but I was at the men's final last year and we saw what happened there, and I'm expecting nothing like that. Whether England win or lose, regardless, I'm really kind of excited to see, just be part of the atmosphere and just be part of the build-up. There won't be drinking from, I forgot what time the game is, but there won't be drinking from like 8 in the morning as there was last year. So by the time you get to midday and it's a hot day, everyone's smashed and a bit leery. I'm not expecting any of that.
Come on, Jordan. You'll have a barrel load of cocaine and a flare up your backside by kickoff. We should move on to Cristiano Ronaldo. We'll be back tomorrow, by the way, to look back at the second semi-final. He met Erik ten Hag yesterday to discuss his future. He's been training at the Portugal national team headquarters instead of going on United's pre-season tour. I love that Sir Alex Ferguson turned up, Jordan. Like, what? Like, surely Ten Hag is thinking, at least I wasn't there when every time the camera panned up and Sir Alex was there. He's got his sit-down chat with Ronaldo, and then he just, opens a cupboard, and Sir Alex is sitting in there going, well, this is what I would do, mate.
But the annoying mother-in-law that just comes over and tries to meddle in your marriage, and it's like, just stay out of it. I've got this. Let me handle my own marriage. I don't think it helps him at all that Sir Alex Ferguson is still looming. He's obviously a large and important figure at the club. But I think that if they're trying to have a broom sweeping of a new era, Ferguson can't still be involved. I get that they probably think that he can get through to Ronaldo and he can bring him back in. But I don't think Ten Hag really wants Ronaldo in that squad. I think he'll see it as a blessing if he can. He doesn't want to be the bad guy, the guy that ends up telling Ronaldo, you're not wanted, sling your hook. But I think deep down, I think if they can find a way for Ronaldo to not be there next season, I think that would be his preference. The Ronaldo thing's kind of, it's getting a little bit boring, but also it's getting a little bit unfortunate for him in terms of how it's ending his career. Because if he stays at United, it's going to be very, very sour because we know that he doesn't want to be there. If he goes to another club, I mean, where does he go? I think that is a conundrum now. Who can afford him that can also offer him Champions League football? There's not really anybody else. So
there was the rumour of Atletico Madrid. And I sort of feel, Robin, actually that really works. There's something really great about him with Simeone.
I think it really would. Yeah. No, I can picture him. Yeah, that was, I really felt that would fit well. And yeah, as Jordan says, it kind of, he'll have Champions League and he'll have Simeone sort of grabbing his package at him. You know, what more could you want? But I think Jordan makes a good point. When they need to change the locks, seriously. When's the manager, the next, how far in the future do you have to go for the next Manchester United manager to not have to deal with Alex Ferguson turning up at a moment's notice? It's just, it's such a burden. And, you know, obviously it's so hard because he's such a legend and he's always going to be welcome at the club. But it's like, it's such an albatross around the neck, isn't it? It's just like, let the manager get on with it.
And in terms of optics, it's not the best thing, is it, really? I think as a player, you want to know who's boss, who's in charge, who's calling the shots. If you're seeing Alex Ferguson showing up every time there's a problem, you know, then you're looking around thinking, well, is Ten Hag really in charge here? Is he the guy that they come to when there are issues, or, you know, he's just making crucial and important decisions about the team and the players and all of that stuff. So, yeah, it is a massive conundrum that they really need to solve. They want to go into this sort of new era under a new manager.
To be fair, I mean, if Sir Alex turned up every time there was a problem at Manchester United, he'd have to basically just live at Carrington, wouldn't he? Anyway, look, that'll do for part two. Part three will be any other business. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Malcolm says, can you try to rationalise why people like Jordan and Richard Keys? Oh, that's good company for you, Jordan.
Wow! Oh. It's not in my way, but that is the note.
Are seemingly so angry to the point of hysteria about Jesse Lingard signing for Forest. In fact, it's a very shrewd deal for both parties. No transfer fee for Forest, only a year deal, so no long commitment.
I've not commented on Jesse Lingard. Hang on a minute.
Have you not? Sorry, Simon Jordan. Oh, I see.
He's throwing you on the bus.
My apologies, Jordan. It just said, the question said Jordan. And so I was like, well, I presume he's talking about the Jordan that I'm looking at. I see. Do you know what? This is really interesting. I was actually on TalkSport on Sunday. Me and Barry are doing our show. And obviously, as you know, Jordan, you've got the texts and the tweets coming into your show from people listening to the programme. But the way the computer is set up, you also get all the tweets that are just being sent to the TalkSport accounts. So sometimes they're just, you're getting all these messages. And for quite a few weeks, I was just like, why are people messaging us about Southampton? We haven't said anything for an hour, but you're getting that. So clearly something had happened about, you know, lots of people had said Jesse Lingard shouldn't go to Nottingham Forest, he should go to West Ham. So then I just said, look, just for the record, I'd like to say, I like Jesse Lingard. I like Nottingham Forest. I hope they both do well. And then they tweeted that out. And even that got Forest fans angry. I just shows that every club has a set of fans who are just on social media very defensive. But Jordan, if you would like to weigh in on the Jesse Lingard situation, now is a great opportunity.
Yeah, actually, I would. I actually think a lot of what's been spoken about Jesse Lingard is a lot of nonsense. And I just don't understand this really old school mentality of, oh, he should do this, he should do that. And Jesse Lingard is the modern day footballer in the sense that he understands and is trying to build a brand for himself. He understands that he's not world-class. He's a good player and he knows his level. It's a one-year deal, which I personally think works for both Nottingham Forest and Jesse Lingard. He might have a plan. I was listening to Rory Jennings on TalkSport a week ago and he said, we don't know. He may have a plan beyond this year that we just don't know about. So this idea that, you know, he's turned down the mighty West Ham and he should have gone to West Ham. It's like, well, you don't know what his plan is. Maybe going to West Ham doesn't suit what his overall kind of vision for the next couple of years of his career is. I think what's more interesting about Nottingham Forest is the energy from the fan base that are so confident they're going to finish mid-table. I'm hearing Forest fans saying, don't underestimate us. We're going to finish about 12th or 13th. And I'm like, maybe just focus on staying in the league, first of all. But the Lingard thing, I think, is symptomatic of an old school mentality regarding the new generation of footballers that are on Instagram, are on TikTok, are building their brand. And I think as long as Jesse Lingard can perform on the pitch, I don't see any problem with him and his extra activity, extra curricular activities off the pitch. It's a very American thing. American athletes have other things going on beyond being an NFL player or an NBA player. So why can't Jesse Lingard make a decision going Nottingham Forest, have his thing on TikTok and deliver on the pitch on a Saturday at 3 p.m. I don't see the outrage and why people are so angry about what he's doing.
I don't get the outrage, but just from my perspective, from someone who doesn't have any skin in this game at all, West Ham, Nottingham Forest, it was just really joyous to see him do well at West Ham. It was really nice, wasn't it? And, you know, he scored loads of goals. They were doing that sort of band celebration. So I think that's the disappointment from people who, you know, who don't really support either side. Just from me, like, if he'd gone back and replicated that, although he probably wouldn't, because I've heard people, you know, compare that to sort of, you know, Joe Willock ran really hot for Newcastle one on loan, and he hasn't really, once he signed permanently, it didn't really. So maybe it was just a nice sort of period for him. But, you know, good luck to him.
Is Jesse Lingard's TikTok good? I mean, I'm not on... I've never logged into TikTok. I sound like an old man. I maybe that ship has sailed for me, Jordan. I don't know.
I've just joined TikTok.
Oh right, okay. How are you getting on?
Not very well. But I get sent videos of Jesse Lingard, and some of them are really funny. Some of them are crap. But regardless, it's what he likes to do, and I just think this kind of old man prism of looking, oh, how dare you not go home and sleep for 19 hours and then train and then play football and sleep again. Like, the guy's got a life, leave him alone. If he's performing poorly for Nottingham Forest, then of course he'll get heat. But I think he likes the idea of being a big fish in a small pond, and I think he'll do okay there.
Just in case Nottingham Forest fans are upset with Jordan calling it a small pond, it is at Jordan Jarrett Bryant. European Cup holders, don't you know? Well, not holders, but they did win it once. Pietro says, how does the Paulo Dybala presentation compare to the Erling Braut Haaland one? I didn't see the Haaland one, but I can't imagine. Anita, I don't know if you've seen the pictures of Dybala in Rome. I mean, that is astonishing, isn't it? I mean, it's like the whole of Rome is filled up with people.
That is insane. And I just think it reflects how football fans can be sometimes in terms of just putting like an individual player on this massive pedestal. But it kind of reminded, I mean, I was like, is it a tribute to someone who's died or is signed for the club? It was kind of that Maradona, like, you know, when he passed away and obviously all the fans came out, which is a lovely thing. That's what it looked like to me. And I was like, is this where football is going now?
Well, it's Dybala. Yeah, Dybala's sitting there, isn't he? Like, he's sitting on the, like, on a sort of raised platform. And I don't know what street it is in Rome, but it's like a massive one, right? And I just wonder what he's thinking. Is he thinking, this is great? Or these people are fucking mad? Like,
how long do I have to sit here?
I'm pretty good, but like, yeah, you're right. I'm not Jesus. Like,
I had to remind myself that he's not even Roman or Italian, because I thought it'd be different. You can understand it maybe if he's Roman, because they're very, very big on, you know, their own. I was like, he's not even Italian. And it's not like, you know, they're signing Ronaldo or Messi's come here. It was bizarre. But then someone deflected me. We were joking about it. And he was saying, actually, it's probably the biggest signing they've made in a long time. They've not made the signing of that scale for a while. So you can maybe understand, but you're right. It was a phenomenal amount of people that had come out.
They love Jose. I mean, you just wait till 4 weeks in when he throws Dybala under the bus. He's not. It's not my kind of player. I didn't want him.
Do you think the people of Nottingham will do that for Jesse Lingard?
Almost certainly, won't they? YP says, in the panel's view, which has a more Twilight Zone feeling to it? Yaya Toure coaching in Spurs Academy or Craig Bellamy assisting Vincent Kompany and managing Burnley? Is that what's happening here? Can we expect to see Yaya as caretaker manager once Conte gets bored of not winning anything and leaving? Craig Bellamy was also Vincent Kompany's assistant in Anderlecht. I suppose they played together, didn't they? They would have played together, Bellamy and Kompany. But you're right, I still can't get my head around anyone that isn't Sean Dyche at Burnley, basically, is too hard to comprehend. And what kind of football... If you think about, I mean, Ben Fisher's on tomorrow. We'll look at the EFL, but Burnley did get relegated, didn't they? Yes, they did.
I like to think that that Vincent Kompany will come out with that crisp white shirt and the tie, you know, as a sort of tribute.
Yeah, and in winter when it's snowing, we wear shorts, and he'll say, but you know, they've lost me, Tarkowski, and Pope, which is quite a significant
and Weghorst as well.
And about Weghorst. But, you know, they're defensive. What they'll do there, I mean, hopefully he'll pick some players instead of them because that's a lot of experience.
He might have to play.
He was quite good, I guess. Hey, Aston Villa news, Jordan. Their fine list has been leaked. Anita, did you get big fines when you whenever you were playing? Was there a big list of things you got fined for?
We did have fines. Whether or not they always got executed is another question entirely. But yeah, we did have fines, and we had fines from everything to like getting nutmegged in training to, you know, showing up late or not having the right kit on, that type of thing. But yeah, you know, nothing that's made me homeless.
Did it make you feel slightly institutionalized? There's all these rules that most adults just don't. We all, you know, we abide by some, but like most of us aren't just like, it wasn't like I was a bit late for this pod. It wasn't like, oh God, it's going to be £18.
The stress of it. Yeah, no. Yeah, a little bit. I think it's just always been a part and parcel of football and a lot of football teams as a way of like maintaining discipline. But of course, nowadays, a lot of clubs, I suppose, and managers like to put it on the players and be like, you decide. What do you want? Do you want fines? Do you want to enforce it? And I guess the worst part of that is you get players that just enjoy looking to upset people and go, oh, they didn't put their seat in at lunch. That's a fine. You know, like little things. You're just a little bit of power. They finally have that reign and they can just like enforce it.
Here we go. Late onto the training pitch, £200 a minute. That adds up pretty fast, doesn't it? Wrong attire on match day, £100 an item. Leaving plates, cups at the dining table, £100 an item. That's good. That's good. You know, teach, you know, some manners. That's good. Illegal parking at football or outside football is £100. We get a parking ticket just out in the street in town. Do you then have to tell Stephen Gerrard and then get an extra £100? Forgetting cakes on birthday, £50 a day.
Ooh, that's the Yaya Toure rule being enforced, isn't it?
Isn't it? Yeah. So is that like every day you're late with the birthday? So if you miss it on your birthday, then every day, wow, that's big. Forgetting your recovery leggings, £50. But they're all on like £80,000 a week, right? It's sort of like one, it's like when my parents would take one penny off me, pocket money, you know. £200 if you're booked for dissent. That was good. If sent off, have to take the team for a meal within 4 weeks of the red card. Oh, that's
I like
nice.
That one.
Isn't it?
I like that one.
The whole team.
It's a lot.
It's like coaching staff, backroom staff.
It's coaching staff and everyone. What if it's like a Suarez in the World Cup, you know, Suarez v. Ghana, right? You're basically taking one for the team. That you then have to, that would be a celebratory dinner, wouldn't it? It'd be nice. Worst player in the small-sided games on MD1, as voted by the winning team, will wear I was the worst trainer jumper the following week for the MD1 warm-up. It's getting it's a little bit too bantery for me, that one, isn't it? They're the Aston Villa fines, if you're interested. If you weren't, you've probably stopped listening by now. And that'll do for today. Thank you, Jordan. I'm very sorry for the early mix-up at the top of part three. That is a low blow. Cheers, Robin. Good luck on Sunday.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Anita. Come on again, please.
Thanks, Max, for having me.
Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Christian Bennett. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.